This is episode 58 of the Creative Giant Show. I'm Charlie Gilkey. Thanks for joining me. What would you do if the love of your life died? How would you pick up the pieces and move on? While these are theoretical questions for many of us, it's the reality for many people every day. And many people are young widows and widowers. Kristen Meekhoff joins me today to talk about her experiences as a widow and her experiences as an author who shared the stories of other widows in her recent book. In case you're new to the show and curious about why we're talking about this, one of the points of the Creative Giant Show is to share a wider range of the human and creative experience than just the Oprah version that we often see. I most want you to see that you're not alone in whatever adversity you're going through, and you can triumph too. Ready? Let's do this.
Welcome to the Creative Giant Show, where we go behind the scenes about what it means to live a life full of creative and professional success. Creative giants are talented, renaissance souls with a compassion-fueled bias towards action. Now, here is your host, Charlie Gilkey.
I'm delighted to introduce you to Kristen Meekhoff. Kristen is a licensed master's level social worker. She is a graduate from Kalamazoo College and completed the MSW program from the University of Michigan. She is a speaker, contributor to Huffington Post and MariaShriver.com, and the author of A Widow's Guide to Healing. She is also a member of the University of Michigan Cancer Center Board. She has been seen on Huffington Post Live, featured on American Greetings and at ABC headquarters in New York, and she's also been a panelist at the Parliament of World Religions. In 2007, she was 33 when her husband died from adrenal cancer. About 3 years after his death, she decided that she wanted to interview as many widows as possible and put their narratives together in her book. She spent 3.5 years talking with widows from various backgrounds to compile the book and share their stories. In 2014, Kristen traveled to Kenya and saw firsthand how widows live on less than a dollar a day. Kristen, thanks so much for the great work you do and for showing up on the episode today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate your time.
Alrighty, so normally I would ask, why did you write the book? Like, how did that start? But given the way that you became a widow, it's kind of obvious, like, what was the catalyst for changing for writing the book, right? And I really appreciate and want to honor the courage that you had to sit down and write the book. I'm currently working with Chelsea Densmore at Live Your Legend, who's a young widow as well.
Actually, oh my goodness.
Yeah, she's 33 as well. I'll connect you after the show too. And so,
okay.
You know, I know how important it is to talk about it. And I don't think in our society, this is something that we talk about enough, but am I alone in that?
Well, I mean, seriously, I know how to clear up the room. I just use words like cancer, palliative care, or hospice, and people get like that look in their eyes of terror and they, you know, head for the door. So I know that death and dying are not something, or loss and grief are conversations people are comfortable having, even if they've experienced it themselves. So I'm aware that that is a conversation that is difficult to have.
Yeah, it is difficult. I mean, I think there's just generally the death and grieving part of it, but I also, like, I feel like, and maybe it's my sort of reading of history, especially around warfare and things like that, like, it was more common to know about widows and widowhood than it is for it to be a topic of conversation and awareness today. It seems kind of like smallpox in a way, and I'm not trying to minimize the experience of any widows. That's actually why I wanted to talk about it, but we just don't. It's not a part of that cultural frame unless you know a widow and then you understand. And like I said, I have another great friend, Julie Daly, whose husband died early. So she's been a widow since she was in her early 30s. There's Chelsea. There's a lot of women that I know who are actually widows. I don't know that a lot, but there are enough that I'm aware of it. So when we think about it, like, you're going through this grieving process. What was writing the book just a way for you to process your own grief, or talk to us a little bit how you went from loss, grief to book?
Well, actually, I do. It was interesting because I do have a master's in social work, which I obtained before my husband ever got sick. And I was telling somebody else the other day that despite having a clinical degree and a graduate degree, nothing prepared me for this loss. And so I spent probably three and a half years after he died reading everything that I could get my hands on about grief and loss. And it didn't have to just be about a spouse that could be a parent, a sister, a child. And it didn't necessarily have to be academic peer-reviewed journals. It could be some, you know, a memoir, something in a newsstand magazine. But I was very interested in how people cope with grief, what some of the physical effects are, and how people, some people seem to be more resilient afterwards. And so, but I couldn't find narratives. And I've always been fascinated by narratives. The first piece that I wrote when I was in college, it was actually, I interviewed Holocaust survivors. And I'll never forget a conversation that I had with Holocaust survivor Stephen Ross. And he told me, he said, never forget that we're not a number. And that meant not the number on there that was tattooed on his arm, but that they are each a story. And there's a story behind each person's loss as well. And so that's really why I decided that I wanted to learn from widows from all different backgrounds. And I wanted to use a narrative approach, which does take much longer than, for example, a questionnaire. And I believe very strongly that we can connect with other people's stories and that it does take away some of the loneliness when we find that we can identify with somebody, even if we've never met them before.
Story is so powerful. Story is just so powerful in that way. In what ways, I'm curious, as a researcher and, you know, with your master's, what is it, best way to phrase this? There's kind of what we know from the clinical side of the house, right? Here's you know, the stages of grief you're going to go through and that type of thing. And then there's that actual real story. In your experience for widows going through what they're going through, which one seems to do more work for them as far as like help them heal in grief?
I'm not sure. You mean what story?
No, like if, so you went, I believe as an academic, right? You went and started reading and researching and you went on that after your husband died. And you ended up creating this narrative approach to it. Do you find that the narrative approach is more healing for more people or the sort of clinical approach, or does it just really vary?
I think personally, and it's sometimes it's hard for me to separate it because, you know, we all have blind spots and everything for our own work. And I think the narrative is what really, really connects with people because when we find that we are able to see ourselves and others, it helps to really be able to identify at a more personal level, which is what happens with a loss. So that's why I connected more with narratives. And that's really why I wrote the book, because I couldn't find many narratives. I couldn't find the book that had a collection of stories of widows from all different backgrounds. And I kept looking for it over and over. And I was kind of putting things together myself, but there wasn't one that had what I wrote and what I was looking for.
What are some of the common threads of the stories that you wrote, that you compiled?
That's a really good question. There were common themes as far as this is despite educational level, how the death occurred, the age of the person when they were widowed, the intense loneliness, the sense of isolation was a common thread. The fact that even though they may, for example, have children at home that were still living with them, or they may have been temporarily living with an adult child or somebody else, the sense that nobody really understood their loss and the pain that came with the grief. And sometimes this was, you know, years later. And it didn't mean that necessarily that they weren't being productive or healthy, or that they weren't working full time or taking care of their children, but they felt this intense sense of aloneness that they felt no one else could identify with, and they didn't feel comfortable sharing it with others. A second theme were the emotional components. And that kind of goes with the first, but they were called secondary losses. So the first loss is obviously the death of their spouse. And the second loss, sometimes they were physical losses. They lost a job as a result. They couldn't maintain their job. Some had to leave their home. They couldn't afford to live there. Some had broken relationships with in-laws and other friends and family. So the secondary losses were a result of the primary loss occurring. And the secondary losses were very, very difficult to handle as well, because it was another change that had occurred.
Yeah, it's salt in the wound, you know? It's like, not only have you lost your partner, but now you're losing these other things that are core as well as a result of that.
Right. And it's very, you know, and then he said, you know, they could handle the one thing at a time, but it's the multiple losses that seem to be occurring. And many said that, you know, they looked to their marriage and also to their partner as a support, main support person, the go-to person. And when that person wasn't there to help them cope with a change in their job or when they were doing solo parenting, it was even more devastating for them.
Okay, so two trends that we have are the intense loneliness. The second is these secondary losses. Are there any other major themes?
Financial concerns and that's addressed, you know, obviously in the book. And it doesn't necessarily mean that a widow is necessarily physically having to leave her home, because she couldn't afford it, although that did happen some. But just adjusting to having to go from what was before to what is current. And that was a huge adjustment, and also not understanding exactly the complete financial picture and what this meant for their life post-loss.
If you can, talk to us about the experience of widows, and especially when there's a time where they're starting to consider or not consider getting involved with another partner. Because I know from the conversations I've had, that's one of those strange things, because sometimes it's not on the radar at all. They're just not, like, it's you go through that and you're just changed in that way, I would imagine. And then others might have guilt about starting new romantic relationships. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Sure. That's one of those things that the first, I think, thing even that precludes dating or getting involved with somebody else was the idea of when you take off the wedding band. And some widows said, you know, initially they would never do that. Some didn't, you know, realize that they just create even more of an intense sense of aloneness without it, that this is the one thing that they were wearing that they felt reminded them of their spouse. And then once they made the decision, some widows are very honest and said that they were involved in relationships with men that were emotionally unavailable. And some had insight, and they realized they were doing this subconsciously because they weren't involved, but they wanted, you know, the physical intimacy. They wanted somebody to be there to do things with, such as go to dinner, go to the movies. So it's kind of filling the void socially. They didn't feel comfortable, you know, going to dinner alone. And then other widows actually would say, be very honest and say things like, you know, I had young children at the time, and I would, I found a partner, or someone actually got remarried, and said that they found men who were functional in the relationship to be father figures for their children. And that once their children turned 18, it resulted in the divorce. And they were insightful enough to say that they realized why they had done that. They wanted to still have somewhat of a nuclear family for the children. And so, you know, people get involved with relationships after loss for, you know, many different reasons. And that's kind of, I was surprised about how open the widows were about their new relationships.
That's an interesting point that you just mentioned about the transparency. And we know that when parents choose to become divorced, right, there's a lot of guilt around that. And there's a lot of... In our society, there's a lot of overcompensation. You give extra gifts and you spend extra time just to, so that you know you still love them, and that, you know, you feel guilty about the broken family stigma and things like that. But, you know, in this particular situation, like, it's not something you chose. And yet, I don't know, is guilt the right word, or is it concern, or what it, I mean, there's still that residue of not having that other parent.
It is. I mean, I don't know. You're right. I don't know if guilt is not the right word, but there's a tremendous void, and it's uncomfortable. For, you know, death is an adult issue, and to have to explain it to young children or any age children, knowing that they don't have their father, unless they grew up themselves without a father, you know, unfortunately due to death or perhaps divorce. It's really difficult to understand how to raise children when a death occurs. And it's a significant death. Obviously, it's their parent. And so I think, you know, solo moms do the very best that they can. And sometimes they're ill-advised. I know I had one solo mom tell me, she said her friends and her family were actually encouraging her to date far too early than when she was emotionally ready. But she kind of followed their lead because she thought, well, you know, they're looking out for her. And sometimes it's Susan, actually, she used the first and last name in the book, just said, you know, she focused on raising her boys and wasn't even considering dating until they had completed high school. So, you know, solo moms have different approaches to this as well.
Let's talk about the label, if we were, the widow label.
Sure.
And how women embraced it, how the people that you talked to both embraced it, but also wanted to reject it. Cause I imagine on one hand, you don't want to be like the widow, like, oh, she's a widow, you know?
Yeah.
Same time, you are right. It's not a weird label. It's one of those labels that have such rich meanings that I imagine that you don't necessarily want to identify with the label, yet you are, and all those tensions like that. Or am I making stuff up on this front?
No, I mean, we had one widow who was very, very incensed that we used this word, because initially, you know, we would say that's the purpose of the book, the intent was to learn from widows, and I would say widows of all different ages, you know, backgrounds. And she kind of was very against the whole idea, but then yet shared her whole story. And so I'm respectful of that. I honor that it is a label. It is, it can have some very negative stigmas behind it. I didn't really know what other word to use. So that's why we did, you know, continue with that, for example, in the title of the book. So it's very difficult. I'll tell you, it becomes really, I'd say, very real the first time. In other words, I know I had this experience when you go to the doctor's office and you have to, you know, they always ask you to update your status form, and they're usually looking for like a change of address or change of insurance, and you have to check the box widow for the marital status. And it's to have to do that you're in a club that, you know, nobody wants to be in at that point.
Bring us into that experience a bit more. I mean, how was that for you? I mean, when was the first time after, I mean, it's hard to talk about, so bear with me, right? When your husband passed and, you know, you had the grief, like, when were some of those moments for you where, like, checking that box struck you in a way?
It was actually less than 2 weeks after he died. I got really sick. I had like the double ear infection. I had bronchitis. I didn't know what was going on. And I had to actually go to this med clinic. And then, of course, these things always happen on the weekends when you can't see your primary care doctor. And I had to fill out this form. And that's when I sat there and they asked for you had to fill in the emergency contact. And I had always was used to writing my husband's name. And I thought, oh, I don't have an emergency contact. I mean, then I looked down and I thought, oh, I don't have, you know, the marital status of being married anymore. And so that was the first kind of moment it really hit me, that physically, you know, I was checking boxes that I had never done before. And then, you know, I was 33 then. And most of my friends, you know, were having kids, or I was getting invitations, you know, to baptisms, or some were still getting married. It was not obviously to funerals that were of colleagues of mine or, you know, friends, because that was not the age group that traditionally would have a funeral for a spouse or a partner. So it was difficult. I mean, I remember meeting Mitch Albom. several years after, and I said to him, I really loved, my late husband loved your book, Tuesdays with Maury. And he looked at me and he said, you look too young to be a widow. And I mean, I guess I didn't introduce myself that way, but he obviously put it together when I referenced my late husband. So it's still sometimes people are kind of, uncomfortable when they see somebody, I think under 50, who has lost their partner.
I'm guessing that discomfort is we don't know what to say, or you don't know, I have my own sort of way in which I could be like, oh, like, because there are all the things that you, it's kind of like people, bear with me on this. It's almost like people who are infertile. And when people ask them, when are you having kids or do you have kids? And there's that level of assumption about their life and their conventional status in relationships that once you're like, oh, you're not having kids. And it's just one of those things that people assume, is it that type of thing, or what's going on there?
Well, I mean, it's hard to know. I remember, late last fall, it was the Met Museum in New York had a whole, they call it Fashion in the Morning, which exhibited attire that widows wore from, the beginning of the century, even before then, until more present day. And I thought, oh, okay. Well, somebody actually sent me the link to it thinking that, you see something and that's what they, and I knew that she was sending it to me for a reason. So it's interesting that I don't associate that way anymore, but people still identify that label with you, years after it's happened. And they mean well, but I think that it's, there's a level of comfort and, sometimes people do stick their foot in their mouth, just like with the baby thing, they assume, or maybe you just, for whatever reason, chose not to have children. And then they kind of look like something's wrong with you, or, they don't know how to get out of the conversation, in a sensitive way. So yeah, it is cultural and there are assumptions that are made, I think, with people, especially of a certain age.
So walk us through this. Your husband dies in 2007. You spend the next 3.5 years interviewing widows and writing the book. You publish the book. What happens then as far as your professional life goes?
Well, I spent 3.5 years kind of researching, and then, like I said, 3.5 years reading. So it's only been 8 years actually this month since Roy died. I continue to work full time and I'm not a writer and, as far as education. And so what has been really, really interesting, and I felt that I did not know this going into the journey of writing, was, discovering all the beautiful kind of friendships that, I was able to develop as a result of this. People have been very kind, have reached out to me, and have been willing to help me and connect me with different professionals who've helped with the book or in some ways supported me in helping me find the right professionals to contribute to the book. And so that's been something that I didn't expect and never would have going in. If you had asked me, what do you think is going to result or what the result of this book will be? And so professionally, I'm still at my same job, but as far as the writing profession, the doors have really opened for me, and it's really an exciting time for me. And I'm kind of in awe of that process that occurred very organically and unexpectedly.
Pull us in. What type of opportunities or experiences or doors have opened for you that have really surprised you?
Maybe a month and a half ago, we're in November already. I was at ABC headquarters in New York, and I was with Dr. Richard Best, and we did an hour-long tweet chat on the physical effects of grief, which is a huge deal. It was live, and this is something that, I had no connections with before. I had reached out to someone at ABC about a year and a half ago when I was first looking at doing something like this, but this wasn't something I ever planned. When I first thought about writing the book, I have had the opportunity to develop a very, very good friendship with Deepak Chopra, who generously gave the cover blurb. And this is, again, something that happened as a result, you know, of my writing, and wasn't a friendship that was established beforehand. I've also met just some really, you know, interesting people. I was invited to the Parliament of World Religion in Salt Lake City. There were like 10,000 people there, and several different nations. And I was a panelist. And this was an opportunity that I was given because they knew about the book. And so those are some of the things that I've been very fortunate to receive.
I'm curious about this, about, you know, you mentioned your meeting with Deepak Chopra. You've also are a architect of change by Maria Shriver, so on and so forth. And last year, you went to Kenya to see firsthand how widows live on less than a dollar a day.
I did do that.
Tell us about that project. I'm really interested in that project and where Kristen is going with this, because it's a very wonderful story.
For those of you who've written, there's a time when you submit the manuscript, and then there's just kind of like you don't do anything. You wait for the editorial process to occur, which is what happened with me. And I thought about, I'm not sure exactly where this came from, but I wanted to learn how widows live on less than a dollar a day. And so an opportunity came up with a very small group of widows, and we went to a place called Kibera. It's one of the largest slums, if not the largest slum in Africa. And many widows are there simply because of their marital status. In Kenya, widows often lose their rights to own property and some financial considerations also. Basically, they're broke. They have nothing. And they're forced to live in the slum with their children. And I was able to develop, you know, I think, a pretty good rapport with many of the widows. And I wrote about it for Huffington Post. And I'm continuously curious about that and looking at a more global approach. And that's why I met with Lord Lumba in London. He has a global approach to helping widows as well, and their children, and empowering them on an educational level, a financial level, and a social level, which are things that, you know, I believe very strong in social justice. And I spoke about that at the Parliament of World Religion.
Let's talk about cross-cultural differences, if you can. So, what were some of the cross-cultural differences and convergences between the widow's experience in Africa versus the widow's experience in the United States?
Well, I only went to Nairobi. I didn't go to, for example, I really would love to go to Uganda. So I can only speak about the women that I met in Kibera. First of all, there is the lack of the ability to own the property. They're literally blamed for their husband's death, no matter how it occurred. Many are unable to attend the husband's funeral because they're considered to be bad luck. Kind of the fourth thing is not being able to be a part of either family, meaning their in-law or their main family, because widows are not well received, simply because of their status. And then being literally forced to uproot themselves and live in poverty is unfortunately one of the consequences of this, of losing their husband. And I know that widows, for example, in the U.S. have to move many times. I know there's strains as far as relationships between families afterwards, but it seemed to be a little more intense and a much more impoverished circumstances.
So it seems like it takes, you know, we mentioned earlier, one, loneliness, two, secondary losses, and those two especially, it really amplifies those considerably.
It does. I mean, not being able to attend your own husband's funeral. I mean, I really, really felt for these widows. When I heard that, and I just, I mean, my heart just went out to them. I can't imagine not being able to have that right or ability to do that. That really stuck in my mind when I heard. I didn't know that, you know, that occurs.
Alrighty, so your book has just recently come out on, what's the date? It just came out this November. November 3rd. And, you know, you mentioned earlier that when you're in the publishing process, so you're really, you know, talking about the book now. Have you considered what your next one is going to be, or are you just really taking it as it goes and going there?
I was thinking, I'm not sure, I mean, nothing's signed or anything, but I was really thinking about ways to help people with any type of loss, whether it's divorce, job, relationship, or a deep friendship that they've lost, healthy ways to deal with that and ways to find a new purpose and meaning in their life when a sudden change occurs or some loss occurs. So not necessarily the loss was because of a death, but like I said, a situation that they didn't anticipate, or perhaps that, you know, it's been very difficult for them to adjust to.
Yeah. One of the things about the book is it's got two focuses, foci. It's got one is for the new widow and another for the family friend. And that's, you know, another thing that I wanted to talk about is what can we do, or how can we be supportive and helpful as family friends or friends or people who care, you know, without getting into over taking care of the widow and making a bunch of assumptions, but being there, being present.
Well, first of all, I think you have to be careful, like you said, to be sensitive, but, you know, because sometimes it is an awkward situation, and to really, if you are going to say that you're going to be there, to actually show up. And I mean, many promises are made. I know widows often told me that they expected that people were going to follow through, and they didn't. So if you, for example, you know, are going to say, oh, yeah, I'm going to help you, you know, clean up all your leaves and rake with you and whatever, then actually show up and do that. And so I think that people mean well. Sometimes they mean to follow through, but when they don't, it is hurtful. And also, not to be judgmental, each person experiences grief differently, and they respond to it differently. And sometimes you don't know what to say, and that's okay. And be careful to not to judge, you know, what you may see happening, or how you feel that you have handled it differently, and offer to, you know, help out, because there are things are very overwhelming physically as well for widows. And it is an experience that it's difficult to imagine happening unless you've been through it, but you know, look around and see some of the things that the family may need. And very small things are not unappreciated. They do go noticed when you do help out. So those are some of the things I know the widows are very grateful for.
So chapter 8 of your book is The Best Advice I Never Got, Things Widow Know. I love that. So share with us some of the things widows, like some of the gems from that chapter, if you would, please.
I'm going to it now. Yeah, so what happened is, this was not an original part of the book. And then what was happening is at the end of the interviews, I would say, is there anything else that you want to say? And they would say, this is what I wish, you know, someone had told me. So that's how, just so you have got the background as to why that's there. You know, one widow, you know, is very, I'd say strong. She just flat says, I strongly recommend that any, you know, widow wait a few years before going and get counseling before they remarry. Another one talks about accepting and understanding yourself, and not trying to become dependent on others. And so it's very, I mean, it varies. One widow said that her own loneliness frightened her, and living alone with a child was not what she'd planned. And she, you know, wasn't it was I'd say pretty deep dark place at times. I remember her telling me about that. And the other thing that many widows will talk about is saying, you know, nobody knew that I was feeling suicidal. And this is obviously very dark, but sometimes widows would say, this is something that, you know, I didn't reach out and get help earlier. Maybe I should have. I'm talking about professional help as well. So those are things that I was kind of surprised to hear. There's some talk about how forgiving themselves for the guilt. They wish they had done that earlier. You know, they're very honest. I mean, that's what was so nice, is that it's straight from their mouth. It wasn't, you know, reading other things.
In your own experience, what's been the most challenging aspect of being a widow that you didn't, I mean, obviously you don't anticipate to be a widow in the first place, right? But what are the things that, you know, you mentioned Roy died in 2007, so you're going on nearly a decade, 8 years or so. What are those things that are just, you know, you're coming from it from a clinical, you have clinical training, and so you know kind of what you're going to be going through, but there's just the emotional living through it that's so much more challenging. What are those things for you personally that you're still experiencing and really having a challenge work through?
I would say, and it's probably because I've been talking about it so much with the book, and that's a situation many, you know, people don't have the opportunity to talk about it publicly, but that sometimes I still second guess myself. And so in the past, I would have obviously asked him, for example, if I had written a book, not obviously about this, but, you know, something else, I can't imagine what it would have been for, but if I had, I would have asked for his input, for his insight. And so that's something that I still deeply miss, and I miss his wisdom on, you know, decisions I've had to make along the way regarding the book. And when I had gone to Kenya, we had actually planned to go to Kenya before he died, not to go to Kibera, but more as at a safari and things like that. So those are things that I am kind of surprised at myself when I look at trying to look at them objectively, that I'm surprised that I still miss as far as, you know, when you talk about the number of years that have passed.
Yeah, I was also thinking about, there's a better term for this, and you would know it, the regriefing effect, in the sense of as you're living the stories that it brings up your own stuff, you know. And I was wondering, you know, as you talk to the women in Kenya and as you talk about the book, like, how are you personally working through that? And, you know, what effect is that having on you?
I think that's a really good question too. I think that it's forced me to look, because each time I did the interview, you know, like I said, I spent 3.5 years doing this, but each time, you know, I found myself, especially at the end, in a different place than when I first started doing the interviews. I'm not sure how it was happening, that it was consciously or just as a result of developing more compassion towards the grieving process, because I didn't really know, you know, someone else to compare it with. So I felt I was doing it on my own. And in the beginning, I would find myself comparing my story to their story naturally, because, you know, it's a situation that we were bonded, unfortunately, by loss. But I think, you know, it's evolved very naturally. And some of the things that I have done, I still do. I still write longhand. That's helped me. I write many things that aren't published ever, that I wasn't doing before. I find that yoga is very, very helpful, because grief and loss many times constricts the body and restricts kind of thinking and feeling. And yoga really teaches you through the postures and the poses how to develop compassion and strength for yourself. And so that's really helped me, I feel, to deal with my own grief and then also the stressors that have come from writing the book.
A lot of your work focuses on this interchange between the emotional journey and challenges and the physical journey and challenges. And so, you know, you had physical effects of grief and it affected your health, correct?
It did. I mean, I was sick. I was on antibiotics for the first time after he died. I mean, and I couldn't remember the last time. And I think, you know, that was a direct result of experiencing the grief. I don't think that I would have been at, you know, that med clinic otherwise. So that was a direct effect. My sleep was affected. I know I had a loss of appetite for a long time, which I attribute to the grief. You know, these are physical effects I had not ever encountered before.
Was that common for other women as well?
It was. Some women, and that's one of the reasons why I did that tweet chat at ABC. Some women, for example, had major panic attacks and actually felt, you know, that there's something called broken heart syndrome. And some actually experienced that. They felt that they were having a heart attack and would find themselves in the ER. Other women found it just not as extreme as they were in the ER, but just felt difficulty focusing, so more cognitive and memory, short-term memory-related issues. Some women most complained about either sleeping all the time and not being able to sleep soundly. And changes in appetite were also very commonly reported symptoms.
So, yeah, let's put that in the bucket of secondary losses.
Yeah.
The loss of the health and the loss of, you know, loss.
It's, you know, it's not easy because those are things that you can't anticipate.
Absolutely.
You know, who wants to be sick, plus you're not feeling supported because your spouse isn't there, and it's not a good place to be.
No, it's not a good place to be. I mean, you've lost your husband, you're sick, that's causing work difficulties above and beyond the stress and anxiety of the grief and loss of your husband. And so you get into, you know, what it would seem to be is a loss spiral, right? You lose one thing and then you lose something else, and it goes down from there.
Yeah, and that's what's also difficult for people who don't have an experience a close loss before to understand when they are, you know, either they love a widow and they feel that she isn't managing her life well or something, or maybe you work with a widow and kind of see her work performance declining, is that it's a major, major change. And sometimes you don't really understand everything that has changed until months and weeks after the loss has occurred. So it's almost every day you're dealing with a new change, and that's difficult. You know, change money may be difficult, but when you compound it with grief and loss, it's even more so.
What was one of the changes that crept up on you? Like you the change happened, but you weren't quite aware of it until weeks or months later.
I don't think I was aware as to how much, it's kind of difficult to put into words, but how much focus and energy it took just to get through the day. You know, before I could easily, schedule activities after the day, or I'd agree to meet somebody, or, you know, I'd do things on my own. But by the end of the day, I mean, I was exhausted by the time 5:30 hit. I mean, like physically exhausted. And I knew, you know, looking back, that was related to the grief and loss, but I kept thinking, okay, isn't that, am I eating something, you know, correct at the right time? Am I, is it because I'm exercising in the morning? Should I be exercising in the evening? I mean, I was trying to figure out all these different reasons why, and then it finally hit me. The low energy level was a result from the death. And so that was a change that I wasn't used to. And I almost panicked because I thought something was wrong with, you know, in addition to being sick, that something else might be wrong with me. But, you know, even small, so someone else would be, oh, that's small, you know, but it is kind of a big thing when you get kind of scared about what's happening and you're not sure why when you experience physical symptoms.
Well, I imagine it's doubly scary because prior to the loss of your husband, like if you got sick or something happened, you had someone else to help out, right?
And you don't have a backup anymore, especially, people who have children and they're solo parents all of a sudden. They said, I have no backup. At least before, if I knew I was running late, I had someone to call. If I had a question or, you know, they were having a difficult day with their child, they knew that they had another parent to lean on, and there's no one there. So you're on your own, and it is very difficult.
Alrighty, so going through the book launch now, you still have your day job, correct?
Yes, I do.
And so you have this book coming out, you're thinking about the next one. What is really exciting for you going forward, or what are you excited about for 2016 and years beyond?
I'm excited about where writing in general takes me, not necessarily if it's a book, maybe it's, a blog, maybe it's doing articles, maybe it's doing things with just other writers that don't get published. But I mean, really excited about being more open to some of these opportunities I see out there for writing in general. And also, I'm hoping that I broke my foot in June. I'm hoping to get back to more running, like, I had done several half marathons before, and so that has nothing to do with writing, but I'm looking forward to that next year, getting back to distance running, and also expanding more with my yoga practice and learning, doing that in a different way as well, doing some different techniques.
Great. Okay, so if people remember nothing else from this episode about you and your body of work, what would you want them to take away?
That having an unbounded outlook on yourself is very important, meaning that I never saw myself doing this. I never saw myself being a writer. I never saw myself getting published. But it is all very, very possible, and it starts from within.
Kristen, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, Creative Giants. So you heard it from Kristen. Having an abundant mindset will take you far. And whether you have had something like this happen, or whether you're just thinking about that next step that you want to take in life, think about what you can do to take that next step and see what emerges. Until next time, stand tall.
Thanks for listening to The Creative Giant Show. To find more tools and inspiration for creative giants, head on over to productiveflourishing.com. Stand tall, creative giant.